the goal is only, I'm not even going to say $1,300. It's a little less than, a little over than $1,300. So go to give, go to WBAI.org, and if you haven't given to that GoFundMe campaign, consider doing that, as well as giving to this radio station proper, okay? So with that said, it is now 1 minute past 7 p.m. Stay tuned for Off the Hook, coming up here on WBAI New York.
Thank you for listening to Off the Hook.
And a very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. I'm Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Kyle.
Yeah, indeed. Right here.
And out there in Skype land, we have Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
We have Gila.
Good evening.
We have Alex.
Good evening.
And we have exciting news. Yes, exciting news. Come join us. We are going to do something new tonight. We're going to experiment with something new tonight. Not on the radio, because we've done everything we can do on the radio. We can't experiment anymore there. But online, we're going to be experimenting with something new, an online chat. Yeah, I know. It's something alien and unknown to most of us. But we are actually going to try and implement that tonight as part of the overtime broadcast. We've been shying away from it because we thought maybe it would be distracting, but you know what? We're going to try it, see what happens. So that means that while we're doing various things, taking phone calls and just embarking in whatever we do after Off the Hook is off the air, you can type things, and I don't know what happens then. People will see them, I guess, if they go to the YouTube channel.
Well, especially for people that may be a little self-conscious or not want to physically say something, or they have something that they've prepared they'd like to say. No, I mean, we'd rather it be spontaneous, but it's a form of interaction that some people who ordinarily wouldn't call, maybe they don't have access to a phone. They're tied up with their workstation. So,
but somehow they have access to a computer.
It's all a matter of preference. We're going to take the plunge, as it were.
Gila.
Also, we're going to have an interesting opportunity this evening to have people in conversation with each other. So, for example, if Bobson calls and you have a question about Bulgaria, you can type your question for Bobson into the chat, and our friendly team of mods will relay it to the Off the Hook studio, or at least that's the plan.
Okay, we don't know what's going to happen. As I said, we've been shying away from this for a long time. And I've been talked into it just as an experiment to see what happens. We're not on next week, so we have a full week to recover from this. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens. Maybe nobody will say anything. That's certainly possible. It's happened.
We are prepared for any eventuality.
Absolutely. That's what being a hacker is. Okay, so moving on, we have some exciting news. From, of all people, the IRS. Have you guys heard about this? The Internal Revenue Service is working on a plan that would allow taxpayers to file directly with the government online. Now, that might not sound like anything at all, but actually it's something pretty big. You ever wonder, you know, when you're filling out all these numbers and forms and hiring accountants and all sorts of other people to do your taxes every year, why do you need to do that when you're basically giving in government forms to the government who already generated the forms? So now I guess everyone's finally figured out that, yeah, hey, the IRS already has all this information. If you want, they could just either bill you or send you a refund check and do the work for you. It works if you trust them, I guess, and if you don't have any shenanigans that you have to engage in to make the numbers a little bit different. I think for most people, this is probably a fairly good deal. I don't know. What do you folks think?
I think it's quite a good deal. I mean, it's something. This is something that I think the IRS has had the technical capacity for a long time, but that the tax preparers have been fighting so hard against, because it is very difficult for them to justify being the middleman in this transaction where you give the government forms to them so they can give them to the government and pay a large amount for the privilege.
Yeah, I can see why that might be an inconvenience to them when you don't need them anymore. But, you know, I still think they'll have plenty of work for people that want to maybe not believe what the IRS tells them or who might have extenuating circumstances. But, again, literally, they have the information already, so other countries do this. As usual, we don't. But it seems like a no-brainer. It really does. Alex?
Yeah, I you know, having lived in the UK, this is the way things were generally done over there. You know, people would automatically file. You would get some form from the government every year, and it was usually correct. You didn't have to do much. There wasn't any kind of affirmative action that you needed to take on your part, really. I think it's a really good thing. Most people who just take the standard deduction and don't have lots of expenses and whatnot are going to, I think, benefit from this tremendously. And I think the IRS will benefit, too, because it will have fewer people not file. Right, as well, because, you know, so their records are going to be better. And I think when it comes to the tax preparers and the accountants and whatnot, you're still going to need them. Although the people that have more complicated taxes, have lots of different assets, or running things through LLCs, they're still going to need those tax preparers, those accountants, those CPAs, and all the corporations and things, and all those LLCs out there are still going to need them as well. So, I don't see this as undermining the ecosystem for accountants in any appreciable way here. It's something that, frankly, I feel like we should have been doing for many, many years.
Yeah, it seems like a baseline of coverage, or if you're going to make a healthcare analogy, or some kind of foundation to do simple filings and so forth that are very reasonably straightforward, that most people would be doing and have had pretty much everything mailed to them and at their fingertips, or and was generated and submitted in other ways, and so it's sort of duplicating efforts. So this consolidates a little bit, and I'm just for as many options as possible, and instead of certain individual companies or, you know, whatever private preparer you can hire, which you know would have maybe a wide variation. That whole ecosystem should be as healthy as possible, not just one entity or two kind of dominating, you know?
You know, we seem to have a tradition in this country, a fairly new tradition of arguing over everything, no matter how obviously sensible it may be. This particular case, yeah, it makes sense to a lot of people, but Rick Hyneman is a spokesman for Intuit, and they're the company behind TurboTax. They don't like this at all. A direct-to-IRS e-file system is wholly redundant and is nothing more than a solution in search of a problem, which is a great soundbite. That solution will unnecessarily cost taxpayers billions of dollars and especially harm the most vulnerable Americans. Okay, let's just look at that for a second. How does it cost billions of dollars to not pay something to your company? How does that work exactly? And exactly how are the most vulnerable Americans the ones being targeted here, when it seems like the most vulnerable people are the ones with the least amount of money who can ill afford to pay somebody else to fill out forms for them, and here it's being offered to be done for free? So, you know, it's a great soundbite, but it doesn't really add up, to coin an accountant phrase.
Yeah, I would say they're not into it.
Oh, nice. That's
I'm
nice.
I'm trying.
That's nice.
Just trying to carry some.
Well, they knew when they made their name someone was going to make that joke at some point. Yeah, Alex, looks like you have something to say.
Oh, that was just a great pun on Kyle. Very, very, very good. But I don't really understand Intuit's position here. It's not really intuitive in a lot of ways.
Were you trying to make a joke just now?
Intuitive? No.
Okay.
Yeah, just,
because it didn't land if you were trying. I just wanted to.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's just, I think it's the power of suggestion right there. But how does this? It doesn't make any sense. It really absolutely does not make any sense, their position. I mean, maybe I'm missing something entirely.
That makes perfect sense, Alex. They're not going to make as much money as they did before. That's why they have this position.
I'm saying the Intuit argument is not intuitive in that how do vulnerable Americans not benefit from
That's yeah, exactly. I think they're basically throwing things at walls and seeing what sticks. You know, they haven't made their argument yet. They've come up with the phrase, but they haven't come up with the logic to back it up.
Well, it also seems to assume that somehow Intuit was helping vulnerable Americans in some way, and they're not going to be able to. I mean, so I'd love to see them expand on that.
Yeah, me too. I'd like to see them expand on helping vulnerable Americans. That would be nice. It's like, you know, when healthcare, the idea of healthcare was introduced during the Obama administration or reintroduced during that administration, and Republicans were saying that healthcare is going to kill us. You know, there'll be death squads, all sorts of nonsense. You know, they come up with the fear mongering first before they actually have, you know, put together a story. So it really sounds kind of silly. Gila, did you have something?
I was just sorry. I'm a little sidetracked. We were hoping this wouldn't happen because people are already starting to live chat in the live chat. So I'm half keeping an eye.
Wait, hold on a second. You mean people can live chat before the channel even becomes active?
Yes.
I didn't know
can.
That. Well, that's not
that,
right.
So I'm just trying to keep an eye on it. The answer for the person who just asked is we're not pushing questions from the live chat to the show right now. This is interactive for overtime, so I'm just making sure that nobody is like.
Do you need me to go in there and disable some features? Because I can do that. I can do that.
Oh, no, you can.
Yeah.
So the answer is not really, and we'll push your questions during overtime. Thank you for the first question we already have, but hold that thought for the next.
Yeah, you see, this is exactly what we were trying to avoid, is being distracted by...
It got pushed, though. It got pushed.
What got pushed?
The question got pushed to the show.
The question got pushed up
overtime just came into the regular show.
Explain something to me with YouTube. Okay, so the channel becomes active at a particular... Or the... it's not a channel. It's... what is it? It's a program?
The video link.
The live stream. Yeah. Live stream. Okay, that's a company, isn't it? Whatever. I don't want to use the wrong phrase. But the live stream becomes active at 8 o'clock, so you would assume that the chat wouldn't become active until then as well. How about we just not look at it until... But then it's gonna be on our permanent record, you know?
This is like the line outside the venue. Like, but, people are talking there in anticipation.
Yeah,
it's fine.
But it's not
fine.
Being logged. When you're standing online, nobody remembers that conversation later. Here, okay, this is my question. We have it set up so that... the chat will replay when people re-listen to the stream or re-watch the stream. How does that work if they're chatting before the stream begins? That's what I don't understand. I guess we'll find out.
We will certainly find out after overtime ends. But if I could encourage our panelists to stay out of the live chat right now.
Alex, really?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Right. Focus, people.
It could be somebody impersonating.
Yeah, yeah.
It's getting out of hand.
Who would do that, Alex? Who would impersonate you?
Yeah,
exactly. Okay, let's move on. We have a lot to talk about. Now, Apple has a great idea. They have previewed a suite of accessibility features that will be coming later this year, and there's nothing we can do to stop it, apparently. The new personal voice feature is expected as part of iOS 17. Is that what they're up to? My. it'll let iPhones and iPads generate digital reproductions of a user's voice for in-person conversations and on phone, FaceTime, and audio calls. In what universe is this a good idea to be able to have somebody's voice mimicked and just bandied about? I cannot think of, I mean, except for, I can think of plenty of uses, you know, nefarious uses for this. I cannot think of a single good use. Gila, did you have an idea?
I had a thought, and my first thought was, my voice is my identity, verify me. But
that's
also
nefarious. That's one of the nefarious ideas I had.
No question. But this is something that I have dealt with on a regular basis throughout my entire life, because I inherited a lot of things directly from my mom, and one of them is her voice. We sound exactly identical.
It's true.
And trying to convince people that I'm not, in fact, her has been very complex throughout my life.
How in the world would this help?
It wouldn't. This is what I'm saying.
There'll be three of you. There'll be three of you now.
Or more. There could be four of us, because we each have, I think my mom has an iPad too. There could be five of us. I am hamstrung to think how this could be anything other than an utter disaster.
Maybe that's what they're going for. Is that possible? I mean, Apple does have a list of disasters. Maybe they need to update that.
Just not update to iOS 17.
What is the selling point? I mean, it seems like it would drive families nuts, like parents getting impersonated for field trips or something, you know, that kind of stuff.
Well,
let
me read how it sounds in the press release. CNBC story. Apple said personal voice, that's what it's called, will create a synthesized voice that sounds like a user and can be used to connect with family and friends. How about deceive family and friends? The feature is aimed at users who have conditions that can affect their speaking ability over time. That's who it's for.
So it's
for that particular use, and any other use is a misuse, right?
You know, I use accessibility features.
Well, this
make a point to.
This is what you need. You need 15 minutes of audio so that the technology can draw upon it. The feature will use local machine learning technology to maximize privacy. Okay, I'm glad they're maximizing privacy. But, you know, we're all on the radio, okay? And need I remind you that our voices are what go out over the air. Anybody out there can get 15 minutes of any of us and do whatever they feel like with this technology. And you know what? You have my permission. Whoever is going to play with this, because it's not going to be me. Not going to be me, at least not immediately. But if you can do something funny or interesting or constructive, let us know. OTH@2600.com. We'd love to hear what you come up with personal voice. And it's all part of a larger suite of accessibility improvements for iOS devices, including a new assistive access feature that helps users with cognitive disabilities and their caretakers more easily take advantage of iOS devices. Yeah, it's all really nice, fun, and good. There's no criticism at all whatsoever in this news story here. But, you know, that's what we do here on this show, is we look at the flip sides of these things. Go ahead, Alex.
This could be an absolute disaster. I mean, I don't really understand why they would roll something out like this. I guess, you know, in certain circumstances, you know, people like Stephen Hawking come to mind, who would, you know, this would have been really helpful to him, presumably, while he was alive, you know, instead of, I guess you would still have to tap out everything character by character from his chair in order for it to have been said, but it just would have been said in a voice more similar to his, whatever that would have been. But in any event, what I've always thought is if you could combine some kind of business email compromise scam, you know, where you're impersonating, let's say, a high-ranking member of your company, together with some kind of like voicemail hacking and voice impersonation, that would be such an incredibly effective way to steal money from a company, right? And this has already happened in the past. There are actually some cases, I think, that were litigated because they were claims to a cyber liability insurer that involved the impersonation or the use of a deep fake voice recording of the CEO of a subsidiary of another company that was then used to essentially shift over some banking arrangements and some nascent payments that had to be made, and the victim company lost a lot of money because of the impersonation of this CEO's voice. And if you think about people like us, we're on the radio very often, but lots of people go and talk at conferences. Lots of people go in and speak on, you know, panels or presentations. And so it wouldn't be very difficult at all to piece together 15 minutes of audio of any CFO or CEO or, you know, even people that work in accounts payable, perhaps. You could find enough, video or audio of them in order to train this thing and then allow you to use it maliciously in some kind of attack. So I think this is, if it's rolled out in the way in which the CNBC story seems to imply that it's going to be rolled out and so accessible, I feel like this could very easily facilitate massive amounts of fraud. And that's not something that is really difficult to foresee. I mean, these are issues that have been out there percolating for a while. So I think malicious actors, you know, the bad guys, the threat actors, are going to see this as a great complement to their pre-existing tool set.
I mean, they often do. And the thing that I was thinking of was, you know, Emmanuel, when you were working with some of the AI voices, right? You were feeding ChatGPT stuff into the AI voices.
I was?
Right, to give ChatGPT voice.
Oh, well, no, actually, that was not ChatGPT. That was a text-to-speech converter.
My apologies. Okay, so the text-to-speech converter. And what we learned eventually was that the text-to-speech converter cannot pronounce my name correctly.
That's right. That's right. It would say Gila, I believe.
Uh-huh, yeah. So unless we fed it carefully. So if you have, you know, something that is a little more complicated to pronounce.
Right.
I think that could feed its own set of problems into it. And, you know, as much as they can try to make it sound like me, for example, if it can't say my voice, if it can't say my name right, that's a problem right there.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just my first thought, which is, yes.
Go ahead, Rob.
There was a very interesting experiment done with this a few days ago by a site called U7 Radio. And I think a lot of people here remember the now long-departed radio host Art Bell, who used to host the show Coast to Coast AM. And U7 Radio is a site full of Art Bell enthusiasts. And what they did was they took transcripts of a bunch of Art Bell's old shows, trained a chat GPT instance on them, and then used AI-based voice imitators to take that transcript of what the ChatGPT generated into audio and basically made a new episode of Coast to Coast AM that's entirely generated and performed by AI.
Oh, wow.
And it's a hell of an interesting thing, and it's about 2 hours long. You can get this at u7radio.org, or it's also on archive.org. And it's uncanny, and you have to really pay attention to notice the weak spots in the AI's presentation. Someone who didn't know any better could listen to this and think it was a genuine episode of the show. It's got a fake art. It's got fake callers. The subject matter seems to make sense until you really start paying attention to it and realize they're kind of talking nonsense.
You know, this isn't the first I've heard something like this. In the rap world, I heard somebody was able to program Tupac to sing a Biggie song, which would have caused a war normally. But it's really believable, but it's all done artificially. I don't know where I fall on that one because it might sound really good, but it's not real. Didn't really happen. What is reality? We're really getting philosophical here, but it's in just a few months since this hit the public, we're being hit with an awful lot to handle.
Yeah, I think because there's so much audio, and that example specifically for us would be a problem, that I don't even really like talking about it, because I'm imaginative and creative enough, you know, why feed ideas? I don't want to be bothered. You know, most people don't want to be bothered by people abusing technology. So I think there's real risk, and if you take steps to kind of protect yourself, that's the kind of stuff that's going to protect you. So, I don't know. I mean, sitting around talking about how a voice could be used to upend your life, I mean, that's just something I'm just not going to bargain with.
Well, I mean, this is what we do. We always figure out ways to abuse technology and ways to make it stronger, ways to make it better, and ways to not just believe whatever it is that we are confronted with, because, you know, a large amount of the time, It's fake, or it's got ulterior motives. Speaking of impersonating people, this story from a site called Hackread, Facebook, the popular social media platform owned by Meta, recently... Was that necessary? Did you need to explain what Facebook was? Yeah, well, who hasn't heard about Facebook? Yeah, we know it's the popular social media. It's like saying... the sun, the big bright object that you see in the sky in the daytime. You don't need it. You don't need to say that. Sorry, don't mean to edit on the air. Anyway, Facebook recently encountered a glitch that resulted in unintended friend requests being sent to users. The horror. when they visited certain profiles, this technical oversight generated a mix of amusement and confusion among users. It's a fine line between those two realms. It temporarily disrupted the practice of Facebook stalking. That sounds like a good thing. The bug not only impacted user privacy, but also raised concerns about the company's ongoing workforce reduction plans. Meta swiftly acknowledged the Facebook glitch, issued an apology, citing it as a consequence of a recent app update. The company stated the bug, as I said, had been fixed, ensuring the intended friend request would no longer occur. Users who were affected received an apology for any inconvenience caused. They said, we fixed a bug related to a recent app update that caused some Facebook friend requests to be sent mistakenly. We stopped this from happening. We apologize for any inconvenience this may have caused. And apparently, people are worrying about the breach of privacy here. In certain cases, the glitch led to friend requests being sent to individual users were trying to block. In other words, people that were that supposedly being blocked were sending friend requests, which is very upsetting to people who are blocking them, obviously. That glitch served as a reminder of the potential risks associated with online platforms and need for stringent privacy settings. We see these stories about Facebook all the time and about how people's accounts are taken over. And compromised. I guess this is just a version of that. I'm looking at another story here from one of the ABC channels about this poor person who lost 15 years of memories. Yeah, they all started when she received a private message from what she thought was one of her friends, but the friend had been hacked. And when she clicked on a link, her account was hacked as well. Never click on the links. They immediately changed the recovery phone number, email, so that whoever's account... they can't recover their account, according to a security expert. She said the hackers then sent out this message to her friends, claimed she made money using Bitcoin, urging them to invest, and they clicked on it, and they were compromised as well. And here's the thing. This is what drew me to this particular story, is that the person who was victimized here, her main complaint is that Facebook has absolutely no way to reach them. There's no customer support to talk to a person to resolve this. They automate so many processes, so many of the things that you're able to change with your account, and oftentimes these are critical things that become difficult to undo. You reach out to the company, you try to get that personalized customer service, and you wait months and months before you're at the head of the queue, and that makes it almost impossible to correct these kinds of intrusions. And then you have people who literally have lost 15 years of memories. That should never happen. First of all, you can always revert. You can always go back to, you know, months ago, years ago even. So there's no reason for somebody to lose everything. And the other thing is that people should not put their entire lives onto social media. Should always have something local that you control. Because, you know, Facebook could disappear tomorrow for one reason or another. But this whole lack of customer service, I've noticed this in many, many places. Many of the big tech companies these days, try calling somebody at Google, try calling somebody at Facebook, Twitter. Hey, we've been having issues with Twitter because we're trying to get that that Hope username. There's no humans to speak to. And we finally trick somebody into answering us because, you know, the Hope username has been unused for years. We never had it, but somebody did, and they stopped using it. And we figure, you know, we run the Hope conferences. Wouldn't it be nice to have a Twitter username that said Hope? So Elon Musk said, yeah, we're getting rid of all the accounts that aren't being used. Sounded like a, you know, a made in heaven type of a thing. So we got through to somebody and asked them, well, how do we get to the head of the line for this particular account? And we just were met with the same, I'm sorry, we cannot help with inactive accounts. We cannot assign inactive accounts. And the point is, it's an inactive account. That's what you're saying you're doing is deleting inactive accounts. And all we're asking is, how do we get that inactive account for the organization that has the same name as the account before some mega corporation does and squats on it? So I hear this. I hear this in many, many places that people are trying to get customer service. You know, it's not a question of a company being too small, not having the funds to run some kind of customer support. These companies are making billions. They're doing quite well. And we're the product. We're the ones that are making that possible. So I think a little customer service is in order on many, many fronts. Yes, Alex.
This is a problem not just for customers, but, you know, think about these platforms, right? I mean, We've known since 2016 that, you know, sophisticated cyber adversaries have used these social media platforms to do really bad things, like interfere with our democratic processes and elections, that they are used to propel massive fraud that's inflicted on people when it comes to things like cryptocurrency scams, that, as you said, Emmanuel, people lose, you know, 15 years of their memories and photos, their life savings, essentially, can be wiped out, you know, as part of a scam. And when you're, even when you're trying to report malicious activity or criminal activity on these platforms, there's nobody there often at the other end of the line. Mm-hmm. Report, use their abuse reporting line. It goes into some ticketing system, and who knows when you're going to get some kind of response. It can be days, it can be weeks, but it's frankly unacceptable when we know that these platforms are used for so many bad things, right? Maybe it's time, given the profit margins that we're seeing at the moment, to take a page from how insurance companies are regulated. Right? Think about this in a sense. You know, insurance companies are required to have some minimum amount of reserves on hand so that if somebody makes a claim, you know, there's money out, you know, that's on hand in order to pay out those claims. And those reserves are very, very heavily regulated from state to state. And I know that there are some insurance colleagues of ours that are probably listening to the show. We'd love to hear from them at overtime, if possible, on this issue. But what if the same type of resource reserve regulation applied to social media platforms where you had to have a certain number of people on hand to answer your customers' questions because you know that digital you know, threats can spill over into physical violence. It can cause things like insurrections at the Capitol, election interference. We've seen, you know, pretty clearly how things can go wildly out of hand in places like Burma and Myanmar as well. So, you know, maybe it's high time that we force them to have these types of employees on hand, because yeah, there's really no excuse for them not to, given the profit margins that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, it's called responsibility, and I think it's time we hold them to that. Speaking of accounts that are being deleted after a period of inactivity, now Google is saying they're going to be deleting accounts that are inactive for 2 years or more. This, of course, is raising some concern about if that applies to YouTube videos, because YouTube is owned by Google. But for now, I think we're talking about Gmail accounts. Now, they're saying that they're doing this as a way to prevent spam. I get more spam from Gmail than I think anywhere else. Their blog post says that abandoned accounts are at least 10 times less likely than active accounts to have two-step verification set up. And once they get compromised, they become vectors for spam and identity theft. Deleting old accounts and freeing up storage is also probably a good way to cut cost, which has been a thing at Google lately. That's according to this Ars Technica article. Anyone else see a problem with this? They're basically saying that, you know, if an account is set up and is sending spam, it's okay. You know, it's fine. No problem at all. The accounts that aren't doing anything, those are the ones that must be deleted because they might be turned into an account down the road, but they're not doing anything to actually deal with the spam problem that exists currently. They're trying to simply delete accounts that don't have two-factor authentication or haven't done anything in 2 years on the notion that one day it will be taken over and there'll be even more spam generated. But I don't think it does anything to deal with all the accounts that are currently sending spam right now. Anyone else have a problem with that?
Yeah, I mean, the long and the short of it is that if you were okay not using it for 2 years, is there really anything in that account that you truly need? But I can see where this is going to hurt people who weren't prepared, like things left in a Google Drive, who people might think, oh, you know, I have that somewhere, you know, old photos, old whatever, and that's going to disappear. You know, old emails, things like that. We've long talked about on this program the issue of when somebody passes away, what happens to their digital self,
mm-hmm.
and we really need to be aware that, you know, for those of us who remain after a loved one passes, like, we need to not only go through their physical items, but go through their digital items as well and make sure we have backups of anything that's there that we want to keep.
Mm-hmm.
So apart from that, I remember just out of curiosity signing into an old Yahoo account and seeing, you know, nothing in the inbox but spam bots talking to each other. So, you know, would that be a loss? I don't think it really would, but we have to be aware of what that means.
Yeah, I can just imagine people are panicking over this. People have been locked out of their accounts for one reason or another, realizing that it's going to be deleted. And, of course, they can't reach anybody in customer service to help them regain control. The Great Google Account Purge is officially scheduled for December of 2023. And, of course, people will get plenty of emails telling them this. But, of course, that doesn't do you any good if you can't get into your account. So there should be some drama in the months ahead as this date approaches. Yes, Alex, go ahead.
The other issue that comes to mind for me is how are they going to determine whether or not an account is inactive, according to what constitutes inactive here? So a lot of people have Gmail accounts that they're just forwarding the mail somewhere else.
That's true. Well, okay. This is how you can tell Google that you are still there. Reading or sending an email, and again, I don't know what that means if you have your email forwarded someplace else. I guess if you send an email and it goes through their servers, maybe that counts. Also using Google Drive, watching a YouTube video, and what they mean by that is watching a YouTube video with, you know, as logged in from your Google account. Which, you know, if you're logged in to your Google account, then I think that should count as activity on its own. Downloading an app on the Google Play Store, using Google Search, again, log in, using Sign In with Google to sign into a third-party app or service. You know, it's relatively easy to do any of these things, but I think, you know, all they have to say is just log in. Log in to your Google account, which is part of your Gmail account, and we know you're still there. Go ahead, Alex.
The obvious import of all of this is that they want you to be logged into your Google account so that they can amass data about your activities across all of your devices, across your browsers, mm-hmm. across everything you're doing. I mean, they're just basically giving people some kind of reason to re-log in so that they can collect more data.
Exactly, yes. And if you use Google without logging in, which you can do and which I encourage people to do, they don't like that because they're not really gathering. They can still get your IP, but they can't get your username. They don't know exactly who you are. And so many people, you know, you read about the people whose search histories have been searched by the authorities because they committed some kind of a crime or suspected of something. Those are people who were signed in searching on Google. If you're not signed in, it becomes a lot harder for any authority to figure out what it is you're interested in or looking up or collaborating on. And, yeah, you might say, okay, it's criminal behavior. They get what's coming to them. But in many cases, it's activism. It's people fighting for democracy in some country someplace. And they have the same risks to face for other reasons. Yes, Rob.
The other population I just thought of that this could affect is people who are arrested and have to serve a jail sentence, maybe spend a couple of years away from connectivity. And so if someone in that situation leaves behind a Google account and is gone for more than 2 years, when they come back, it'll be gone.
It's true. That is true. That's a good point. I never even thought of that. Wow. Okay. Story about ChatGPT that was posted on Forbes. This was apparently going viral over Reddit the past weekend. This particular post said, "My professor revealed to us that a student in his class used ChatGPT to write their essay, got a zero, and was promptly suspended. And all he had to do, all the professor had to do, was ask ChatGPT if it wrote the essay." Yeah, and so that is putting people into a panic. But I think we can all say with some degree of authority that it's nonsense, that you can't just ask artificial intelligence, is this artificial intelligence, and get a truthful answer. What you can count on is some professor thinking, hey, you know, this is the way to put the fear of the Lord into my students so that they don't ever use ChatGPT to write an essay, by telling them that this happened to somebody. And they'll start wondering if they're next. You can do that, but you know, try it. You know, have something written by ChatGPT, feed it right back into it, and say, "Did you write this?" They're not going to own up to it. They won't. And you know, there are supposedly apps out there that will detect this. I fed one of my own pieces into it, and it told me that it was written by ChatGPT. It lied. And artificial intelligence got credit for writing something that I wrote, unless I'm actually part of some experiment that I haven't yet realized. These are the questions we're all going to be facing in months, years, decades ahead. And I think, you know, you're seeing a degree of panic everywhere in newsrooms, in college professor lounges. People are worried that there's going to be a lot of cheating. But I think, you know, if you're awake, if you're paying attention, you'll be able to figure it out. You'll be able to see. You'll find the signs in one way or another. Kyle?
Yeah, in that instance, I think that might be just a bit of subterfuge so that they think that this is so simple, but maybe in actuality it's to hide the tools that they might have access to in academia. Because they've been doing, software-based recognition for plagiarism and so forth in higher education for quite some time. So I would not put it past the kinds of developers that provide these tools for university and educational environments that they're trying to add on or make modules or ways of incorporating some of the new tools that use this stuff, but I don't think it is as like drag and drop as that teacher may have said.
Yeah, you know, plagiarism is easy. You know, it's easy to detect that because you're looking for the same words. You're looking for, you know, a similar sentence structure. And here it's a bit more creative. But, you know, there's other ways to tell, too. Even if you can't tell for sure if your student has used ChatGPT to put something together, you'll know if they can't actually explain what they're talking about. Apart from just being nervous, if they actually don't have a grasp of the subject, you'll know. There's other ways besides what is being written on a piece of paper or on a disc to determine if somebody is actually cheating or not.
Absolutely. There was a reply to the Reddit post about this that blew up on the ChatGPT subreddit, and a reply by someone called My Red Shoelaces says, "I've put decade-old college essays into ChatGPT-4 and asked who wrote it. GPT-4 claims it wrote them.
Mm-hmm.
Even after I tell it to correct itself because I wrote them, it will initially apologize, but when asking it again in the same conversation, it will claim it wrote them again. AI detection is a load of utter BS." It goes on to discuss that ChatGPT is a large language model, and it's not in itself an AI detector. Its job is to answer your questions with text that's somewhat shaped like a reasonable answer. It doesn't fact-check those, as we've explored very much on this program over the past months. It doesn't make sure that it's correct. It just constructs something that the algorithm thinks would be an answer to that question.
Now, ChatGPT, it's a big fat phony. That's what it is.
Absolutely.
It's a big fat phony.
But it wants you to think that it did it,
uh-huh.
Right?
Uh-huh.
So the more, if it's a language learning model, anything it grabs, it's like the Borg, basically. Anything, it assimilates everything. So if you give ChatGPT something, it's going to think it wrote it. It's going to think it's part of itself. Right? Isn't that how it works?
Sure. I don't know. I feel like if you made a limited mode of this, and there are other types of these language models out there, there's a lot being made of some of the open source versions of this that are emerging. I don't know if we have any stories about that, but we can cover it in detail later. But if you made a sample that was only trained on a class of like 33 people that only write and have written, you know, their samples, and that's all it's based on, and maybe some other dictionaries or something really, really pared down, and then one of those 33 comes through with something that it's not recognizing. I mean, I guess that's something that they would use as a tool for plagiarism, but I feel like if you limited it enough, it would notice an aberration in one of those 33 that it had a very limited sample of, instead of having something like GPT-4 or, you know, Infinity or whatever they're on now, like, instead of that being, you know, this so comprehensive, if you made it narrow, I feel like it would maybe be able to see that, like, hey, this is not the way this person has used language before, and I predict it's certainty that it's wrong or fake in some way.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there as far as this particular conversation. We can pick this up in overtime at Channel 2600 on YouTube at 8 o'clock. Please join us there. I wanted to just spend the last couple of minutes of the program discussing what's on all of our minds, especially you guys out in Skype land. Eurovision, what was your favorite Eurovision piece this weekend? Really? Nobody? Nothing?
I didn't watch it.
Are we that American that we have no interest in what's going on in foreign lands?
Well, you know, I read the FT and things, but, you know, Eurovision doesn't
say, you're trying to compare reading Financial Times to, okay, fine. That's yeah, okay.
It must
Yeah, so tell us, Emmanuel.
I was giving you the opportunity to basically say if there were any pieces, because, okay, for what Eurovision is this international competition, mostly in Europe, but they also include Israel and Australia. It's basically each country has a song. It's about 40 countries, and they have a competition over an entire weekend. Every song has a video attached to it. No song is more than 3 minutes long. You can look at all the videos on YouTube. And inside of a week, I got to memorize all of these songs. They're that catchy. They're kind of they're a throwback to your childhood, where every song was something that you remembered. And the thing is, what I found amazing is the activism that you see basically raising its head in all the expression. For instance, Ukraine won last year. And as a winner, they got to host it this year, but of course they couldn't host it because of the war, so it was hosted in Liverpool, and Liverpool just pulled out all the stops for Ukraine, putting Ukrainian flags everywhere and just showing all kinds of support. It's a really beautiful show of you know, art and music and activism, like I said. Anyway, one of my favorites was Croatia. And I really thought these guys did an incredible job with an anti-war song. The band is called Let Three. Now, they caused a bit of a stir online with a drag meets military pomp extravaganza. And you just have to watch the video to see for yourself just what these guys got up to. Basically, they said we're a bit surprised at people's reaction, but when it pays off, it's so exciting. The inspiration behind the song, which we're going to close out the show with, they revealed it came about through members of the band putting on an adaption of an anti-war play, and through that, the idea of making a small and condensed anti-war rock opera came. Mama SC is the name of the song. It's the result of that process. They said, we're presenting an army of love. It's military, but it's positively military. Looking at this video, I'm reminded of Johannes more than anything. And you guys, you know, anyone who's been to Hope, you need to watch this because I think you'll definitely feel the same thing. It is the right time to send a message like this without any further explanation. And bandmate Damir Martinovich added, "It is the army of my ass," and you can just interpret that however you wish. But just a couple of things about the band Let Three, so that people can appreciate how they basically stand up to authority and just do what they please. And I hope that's what our listeners always do. Let Three was formed in the city of Rijeka in the late 1980s. Yes, they've been around for quite some time. The band soon gained a reputation for their unprecedented, controversial, and sometimes obscene performances, exemplifying the eclectic nature of Rijeka's music scene. And now I want to see that place more than anything. The band's members have voiced support for liberal causes such as women's and LGBT rights, and have taken a vocal stance against conservative politics and the Catholic Church. In 1997, the band released their fifth album titled Outrageous or Unheard Of in English. It was distributed as a CD, but it had nothing recorded on it. Nothing at all. Nonetheless, 350 copies of the album were sold. Just one copy of their follow-up, Jadina, the only one, was initially made. The band refused to sell or distribute it. One copy. The record company eventually released the album in slightly different versions, and as a protest to that, the band staged a fake suicide by firing squad in the middle of the square in Zagreb. as you can see, record companies probably have all kinds of nightmares working with them. In late 2000, the band unveiled a 4-meter-tall statue titled Grandma's Penis, depicting a woman with a horseshoe mustache and a 1-meter-long phallus. It was exhibited in various cities through Croatia. Yeah, Eurovision is not exactly what you thought it was, is it? No, it's really interesting and really a whole lot of fun to just witness. In December 2006, the band was sanctioned by police after performing naked at an open-air concert in Varaždin. The band's defense that they had not been naked because they had corks in their anuses did not convince the judge. The court found them guilty and fined each member approximately 50 euro. On December 14th, 2008, the live afternoon talk show, Nedjelum I Dirva, was cut short by the host after two of the band members simulated the ejection of a cork from their rectums. And it's all kinds of other things as well. December 9th last year, Let Three was announced as one of 18 participants in the regional competition to come up with the song for Eurovision. The Croatian national selection for the Eurovision Song Contest of 2023, and their song Mama SC, which we're about to hear, was selected overwhelmingly by the crowd in Croatia. And this is what we have times 40. That's what Eurovision is. So next year, folks, I hope people in America, it's hard to find, but you can watch it in various streaming platforms. It's so worth it, and you feel like you're a part of something even bigger. So That's why I get into things like this. It's a different, unique system. So we're going out with the Croatian song from Eurovision. We're going to join you again at 8 o'clock on YouTube, channel 2600, or just click on the link on the 2600.com webpage. And write to us, oth@2600.com. And don't forget to support WBAI.org or WBAI 99.5 FM. And call 212-209-2950 to make a pledge. And we will see you next in 2 weeks. We are off next week. Here's Let Three. Mama kupila traktora.
Мама купила трактора, тройна Нина, Армагеддонуна. Мама купила трактора. Мама купила трактора. Мама купила трактора. Тройна Нина, Армагеддонуна. Мама любила Мурона. Мама любила Мурона. Mama